say more than a million Israelis joined demonstrations across Israel calling for an end to the war in Gaza. We'll speak with 972 reporter Aaron Zeev. Stay with us.
Let's go back to sleep, Rahaf. We're so tired. See the bunny sleeping till it's near the moon. Shall we wake them with a merry tune? They're so still. Are they ill? Wake up soon. Let's pretend to sleep. Wake up, little bunnies! Skip.
Ms. Rachel, dancing with Rahaf, a three-year-old double amputee from Gaza who lost her legs in an Israeli airstrike and came to the U.S. for medical care. On Saturday, the U.S. State Department halted all visitor visas from Gaza, including for children like Rahaf. The move was announced one day after far-right activist Laura Loomer posted a video complaining that injured Palestinian children are coming to the U.S. for care. The U.S.-based Palestine Children's Relief Fund cried what it called a, quote, dangerous and inhumane decision, unquote. You can go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Ms. Rachel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Israel, where over 500,000 people protested in Tel Aviv Sunday to demand an end to the war in Gaza and for the Israeli government to reach a deal to free the hostages in Gaza. Over a million people took part in protests across Israel as the families of Israeli hostages called for a nationwide day of stoppage. This is Lishay Moran Levy, the wife of Omri Moran, who's being held in Gaza.
Last week, we decided to call to everyone in Israel, to all the citizens, to stop. Take a day and stop all the country in one saying, please release the hostages, bring them home, and stop the war. We are very caring about our dear that over there, my Omri is over there 681 days. I miss him. Our daughters, Roni and Alma, really miss him. And I'm really, really scared and afraid about his life. I want him here, and I want all the hostages here.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blasted the protesters, saying, quote, those who call to end the war, delay the hostages' release, and guarantee the horrors of October 7th will return, unquote. For more, we go to Aaron Zeev, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine and the independent Israeli news site Local Call. Aaron, welcome back to Democracy Now! You were covering the protests. Can you talk about the significance of the size of these protests and what exactly the Israelis were calling for?
Thank you for having me. I think it's really interesting moment because over the past almost 2 years, we've seen a big protest, but not huge like that. And we've seen also moments during the war with Iran, with Lebanon and other occasions that the numbers were really low. People, you know, Netanyahu is doing what he's doing the best and is dragging time and making people tired. And this is also true to the Israeli public that went in tens of thousands in the last year and a half or 2 years. But yesterday, a big and a significant number of people went out. And it's even more important with the incitement we've seen from Netanyahu and other ministers that were even more harsh than Netanyahu, saying the protesters are helping Hamas, making the price of a deal higher and so on. So in the fact of in the end of this day, during the day, there were hundreds, if not thousands, small vigil, direct action, roadblocks. The country was shut down, basically, traffic-wise. And in the evening, we saw one of the biggest vigils and demonstration we've seen in recent years of almost 500,000 people in the streets in Tel Aviv. And this is, first and for all, a message from the Israeli public. And what the polls show, that the vast majority of the Israeli public is willing to end the war in order to release the hostages. Now, it's important to say that this is from an internal Israeli perspective. It's not like like the protests we see abroad. These are people who are calling to return the hostages in any price. And after 2 years, many of them, many in the Israeli public, blame Netanyahu. He's trying to blame Hamas. But many of the people, or the most of the people who went out yesterday to the streets, are blaming Netanyahu for not doing a deal to survive politically. This is a very common statement you hear from everyone on the streets, and they're calling to end the war. They've seen in the last 2 years that only political agreements and ceasefire agreements bring back hostages alive. We've seen over 40 hostages that died in captivity, either from the army's attacked or from reaction of Hamas when they were trying to, when the army was coming nearby, and people had enough. In the same time, it's important to say that the vast majority of the protesters yesterday, although the fact they called to end the war, they're not speaking directly on the suffering in Gaza, on the killings, on the children, on the starvation. You can hear it here and there. You can hear it from smaller groups that have been protesting from the beginning of the war against the genocide and then the ongoing ethnic cleansing. But it's not on the stage. It's not the main message yet.
I wanted to get your response to how Israelis have responded to Israel's Channel 12 airing those leaked recordings of Israel's former military intelligence chief saying 50 Palestinians must die for every victim of October 7th, saying tens of thousands of Palestinians must die. In the recording, Aharon Haliva is heard saying, quote, "It does not matter now if they're children." He said, quote, "They need a Nakba every now and then to feel the price." Oren Ziv.
So to be honest, the vast majority of the discussion inside Israel was regarding the fact that this person, that many Israelis see as the responsible for the catastrophe of October 7th, for the failure of the Israeli intelligence to finding out that this will happen. So people thought this kind of leaked recording, some people say that he might have leaked it out, are kind of serving him to clean him and to blame. The problem is the general system. So in Israel, the vast majority of discussion was about that. Was it really leaked? That is it serving him? Why, you know, many people, hostages, family members, hostages are saying he should be trialed and sit in prison. But this segment didn't catch a lot of attention in Israel because, unfortunately, this is very common. It's something we heard from day one, from politicians, from army people, in the public, in right-wing demos we hear it. We hear it everywhere. So, unfortunately, this didn't cause a lot of noise in Israel, but definitely it shows you that such a high commander saying these things openly, you know, without being ashamed and without getting any attention in Israel, shows you that this decision of revenge, of genocidal war, was done from day one. And Israel also, to cover the failure of October 7th, decided to go to a revenge, a horrific war, as we're seeing now. And you can see that this decision is not just by soldiers on the ground or right-wing or extreme so-called settlers. This is all across the army, from the high-rank commanders and the politicians to the simple soldiers. And now when we see the horrific reality in Gaza after almost 2 years, we can understand this was planned. The army felt they have to revenge to cover up the failure of October 7.
I also wanted to ask you about the Israelis who are refusing to enlist in the Israeli military. You just posted a short video of 19-year-old Yonah Rosman, who was sentenced to 30 days in military prison.
Today I'm going to show up at the draft office and declare that I refuse to serve in an army that's committing genocide, and for that I will probably be sent to military jail.
That's Yonah Rosman. How common is this, the refuseniks?
So it's not very common, especially in mandatory service. 18-year-old high school students are all the system, all their life, all the education system is pushing them to go to the army. That's the norm. In order to be like Yonah and other brave young Israeli, you have to go against the stream and to educate yourself and to go to demonstration and meet people and not to watch the Israeli mainstream media who doesn't show you what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank. And so it's not very common, but we've seen some increase in the number already from the beginning of the war. more than 12 announced ones who went public, a youth who refuse and they pay a price. It's on not only 30 days in prison, they have to go again and again to prison a few times. But among reservists, we've seen a growing movement of people refusing because of what's happening in Gaza, also calling to release the hostages. And we've seen hundreds of people refuse. With some of them, the army chooses not to deal with prison, but to release them quietly. Specifically about Yona and her group from Meservot, refusing in Hebrew. They are showing, they want to show that not everybody in Israel, that there is a small group who resists the genocide and the horrific things the army does. And as she told us, that's her duty. That's the only thing you can do when you see what the army is doing. She told me in an interview before she went to prison that she decided even before October 7 and before the war in Gaza to refuse. But after the genocide started, it was much easier for her to take this decision. And we hear it from other refuseniks as well. And, you know, it's very hard when she appears on social media, on national media, they get a lot of incitement, hatred inside the prison, and also when they go out. Last month, they burned some of the enlistment orders in the streets in Tel Aviv. And to do something like that in the general atmosphere in Israel that is very hostile to this action is very, very brave.
I finally wanted to ask you, as you cover protests, yes, the protests this weekend of a million Israelis, but also about the protests outside the hotel where GHF staff were staying in Tel Aviv. That's the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the shadowy U.S.-backed Israeli company that is supposedly providing food aid, but when people come, they are often shot dead as they try to seek food, children and adults alike. What about that protest?
So last week, a group of activists, radical left-wing activists, located where the so-called GFF staff, including CEO and other senior members, are staying in Tel Aviv because, you know, they work in Gaza in coordination with the Israeli army and other companies, but they're staying in a very fancy hotel in the shore of Tel Aviv. And they wanted to come there to send a clear message that this is not accepted, that they're not welcome here, and to stop this lie that is called the Gaza Humanitarian Fund. So they came there, around 50 protesters, to surprise. The police was not aware of it. They arrived there to the entrance of the hotel. We know from people inside, they heard them inside the hotel. And they were protesting there for about an hour. The police was trying to push them away. Some tourists and people who passed by tried to confront them. And this happens, by the way, in every demo like this against the genocide, against the starvation in Tel Aviv and other cities that are often attacked by the Israeli public. The Israeli mainstream media doesn't show the images or the voices from Gaza like you do and many other media outlets. So when the Israeli public is met on the streets with people who are trying just to show the fact, to shed light on what's happening on the other side of the fence, people are many times surprised or even angry and try to attack the protesters. And they're telling me this is only one of first actions they will do against the GHF operation here in the region.
Oren Zeev, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine and the independent Israeli news site Local Call. When we come back, we go to Annette Gordon-Reed, president of the Organization of American Historians. President Trump has ordered a review of how U.S. history is told in Smithsonian museums. We'll also look at a curriculum that is being adopted by at least 10 states that's put out by PragerU. Among the videos children are shown is an animated Christopher Columbus talking about why, well, slavery was better than death. Back in a minute. Destruction on every hand. Black waters, black waters rise over land. A quail, she's a pretty bird. She sings a sweet tune in the roots of
explodes and the dynamite's roar. The voice of the small bird is heard there no more.
Blackwaters, performed by Nora Brown and Stephanie Coleman in our Democracy Now! Studio. They joined us in March to talk about their recent appearance at the Kennedy Center, where they unfurled banners to protest President Trump's takeover of the famed cultural institution. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at plans by the White House for a far-reaching review of Smithsonian Museum exhibitions in order to ensure they align with President Trump's interpretation of U.S. history. That's according to The Wall Street Journal, which obtained a letter from a White House official instructing that Smithsonian exhibits could be, quote, accurate, patriotic, and enlightening, ensuring they remain places of learning, wonder, and national pride for generations to come, unquote. In March, the president signed an executive order directing officials to eliminate, quote, improper, divisive, or anti-American, unquote, ideology from its museums. This latest plan comes after the Smithsonian removed references to his two impeachments during his first term in office. Press for details. This is President Trump speaking last week during the signing of an executive order.
We want the museums to talk about the history of our country in a fair manner, not in a woke manner or in a racist manner, which is what many of them, not all of them, but many of them are doing. Our museums have an obligation to represent what happened in our country over the years, good and bad, but what happened over the years in an accurate way.
The Smithsonian has said they have returned the references to Trump's impeachment. For more, we're joined by Annette Gordon-Reed, a Harvard history professor and president of the Organization of American Historians. She is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. And her most recent book is titled On Juneteenth. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. Let's begin with the Smithsonian. And of course, also so significantly, what's happening to the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture?
Well, it's something of a—not a shock, because we see other things that are happening at the same time, but the idea that the Smithsonian, which was created as an independent entity, should reflect any administration's vision of history and not the vision of the historians and the researchers and the other people who devote their lives to studying these things is more than problematic, I would say. So it's not a shock, because we can see what's happening in other arenas, but it is something that's a departure from what should be expected, what is right, actually.
Talk about the founding of this museum, what it took, and how interesting. I mean, years ago, I did an interview with Lonnie Bunch, who was the founding head of the African American Museum of the Smithsonian, who then was elevated to be head, as he is today, of all the Smithsonian museums, and what this means to President Trump.
Well, I think there's an attempt to shape the narrative of history. As we know, history is political in many ways, and this is an opportunity, he feels, the administration feels, to put his stamp on the way we tell the story of America. And I don't think that this is something that the American people want. We see survey after survey that indicates that people support the idea of a capacious and a truthful, unvarnished picture of American history, because that's the only way to figure out what happened in the past. There's no way to learn if you don't know what actually happened.
I want to go to an issue of curriculum in this country that also will affect the Smithsonian museums. Starting this school year in Oklahoma, teachers must earn a teaching certificate to be able to teach in the public schools of Oklahoma this school year. And what an Oklahoma school official says will keep away woke indoctrinators. The assessment was designed by PragerU, a conservative media company, the talk show host Dennis Prager's company, whose educational materials have been approved for use in public schools already in 10 states, including Arizona, Florida, Texas, New Hampshire, and Louisiana. One of their recent videos, which kids are shown, which has gone viral, features a cartoon of Christopher Columbus downplaying and justifying the practice of slavery.
Slavery is as old as time and has taken place in every corner of the world, even amongst the people I just left. Being taken as a slave is better than being killed, no?
Being taken as a slave is being better than being killed, no? As if also they're mutually exclusive. Annette Gordon-Reed, can you talk about what is being taught here that kids are being subjected to and the larger thread? And if you feel it's a white supremacist take on history?
Well, it's an attempt to play down or downplay what happened in the United States with slavery. Of course, slavery has existed since biblical times. People know that. That's not something that has never been acknowledged. But the question is, how did it play out in North America from American history? How did we do it? What effect did it have on the people who were enslaved and what legacies are still there? This is a way of trying to prove that nothing bad happened to African American people, that there's no reason for any kind of redress, that there's no reason to pay any attention to the legacies of slavery. So this is something that they've long wanted to achieve, and because they are in political ascendancy at this moment, that they can do it. But this is a whitewashing of history.
Annette
Gordon, the guise of making white children feel better about themselves. I mean, the thinking is that they feel guilty. And that has not been my experience in talking to young people about slavery, the institution of slavery. They know that they are not responsible, that they didn't enslave people. There's no reason for them personally, but it's reason for them to understand why things are the way they are, and how we go about creating a fair and multiracial society.
I wanted to go back to your Pulitzer Prize winning book, Professor Gordon-Reed, to the Hemingses of Monticello and American Family. And if you would talk about how Sally Hemings and the family has been talked about in the past. I remember going on a tour where she was not discussed as an enslaved person and having to ask a question of the tour guide there. Why aren't you telling us more? Talk about the story as you feel it needs to be told. And do you believe that narrative is threatened today in places like Oklahoma, right up to the whole Smithsonian array of museums?
Well, there's been a sea change in the attitude at Monticello about how you talk about Sally Hemings. There's actually a tour that's devoted to the Hemings family, and her story is told there and in a particular room that we thought she may have lived in for a time at Monticello. It's important because it shows you that this country has never been just a white country. It's a country that involves slavery, which was not just making people work without pay. It was a society where blood mingles. There are people enslaved their own family members. And that's something that I think people should know. And my experience in talking to people about this is that Americans want to know history, want to know the accurate history. That story may be imperiled. I mean, there are always people who fight against it because they think it reflects poorly on Jefferson, that it makes him something other than a white person in a way to have had children with a woman who was African-American, a part African-American. But we always fight these battles, and it's a continuing struggle, and that's the nature of it. We have to defend what is true and follow history to follow the truth to wherever it leads us.
Professor Gordon-Reed, I also wanted to ask you about these latest developments. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recently announcing that a Confederate memorial removed from Arlington National Cemetery would be put back. The 32-foot bronze statue was actually installed almost 50 years ago after the Civil War ended in 1914, as well as reinstalling a statue of Confederate general and alleged Ku Klux Klan member Albert Pike. Pike in D.C. that was torn down by Black Lives Matter protesters back in 2020. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, the significance of it is that it's somewhat akin to why they were put up to begin with, as a statement about white supremacy, I think, and promoting this notion. There's no reason to honor people who attacked the United States of America, fought against the United States of America. This was a way of sending a signal to African-American people in the community and the places where these things were put up all across the South that we were not really a part of America. And so, and I think it still has the same message today. Mm.
And I also wanted to ask you, as a professor, I was just reading an article about Howard students returning to campus, especially the first-timers, you know, actually the freshmen who are coming to Washington, D.C., and being afraid to step foot outside their new dorms because of the occupation of the city by National Guard troops and what could happen to them if they take one false step or even if they don't do anything that they know is a problem. Can you talk about the significance of what's taking place?
Well, it's sad because this is, should be a time of excitement, looking forward to a future. And the notion that you feel threatened by being in the place where you're that's supposed to be your new home for 4 years, you're beginning your journey in life is a terrible thing. But I think in general, this is a part and parcel of all of this is together. It's a movement to, I think, marginalize African-American people even more. I mean, Washington is a city with a large Black population. The optics of it suggest that this is a desire to sort of take control and to send the message that we aren't really a part of this society. And that's the great tragedy of it.
Finally, Professor Gordon Reed, I wanted to ask you about your new book on Juneteenth. It's part history, but also part memoir and meditation on your own growing up in Texas, the original home to Juneteenth. Tell us, in the midst of this climate, what it means to you.
Well, it means it's sort of interesting because when it became a federal holiday, it looked like this was a chance for people on a yearly basis to talk about, an occasion to talk about slavery and the legacies of slavery. And now I want that could be in jeopardy as well. I mean, we've been celebrating this a holiday as a state holiday in Texas since 1980. This red state or this purple, you know, gerrymandered state has been celebrating Juneteenth since 1980. And the idea that we may pull back from that, or we have pulled back from that, is a little disheartening. But I think we will, you know, we will continue. I mean, people celebrated in 1875 and the end of Reconstruction every year since the day itself. So I continue that we will persevere. I'm assuming that we will, in fact, persevere and go ahead with it. But it's definitely under attack now in this whole measure, this whole effort to take things back, roll back the civil rights movement and roll back advancements for African-American people.
Annette Gordon Reed, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Harvard history professor. Thank you. And president of the Organization of American Historians. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. And her most recent book is titled On Juneteenth. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadara, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.